Welcome to the Derek Loudermilk Show. This is episode 393 with Bruce Cryer. Bruce Cryer is a singer, dancer, creativity trainer, and the former CEO and co-founder of the HeartMath Institute. Today we're going to hear the story about how he got involved with HeartMath, the early days and the founding, and how they brought the scientific discipline of studying the heart to the wider world. We'll also cover topics like AI and how it interfaces with our humanness, how Bruce wrote and created his first musical album, and some of his other projects like Renaissance Human and the Integrative Health Institute. So without further ado, here is Bruce Cryer. Bruce Cryer, welcome to the show. Good to see you again.
Great to see you too, Derek. This is fun to be here.
Yeah, it's been great getting to know you over the last few weeks. I feel like we have it's so interesting. We were talking about, you know, these different networks and our networks, our communities seem to be like overlapping in multiple different areas. It's always interesting when someone pops into your life from like multiple different angles. It's like, oh, there must be something here. So I'm happy to have this conversation with you today.
Yeah, I agree. I find that lovely and fascinating, especially when you discover who are the people that are the interconnections. And oh, you're a friend of Preston. Oh, you're a friend of Tyler. And like people that I really value. So like that elevates the other person a lot in my eyes, because you're connected to them. Those are like some of my most awesome friends at all. So it creates an extra level of connection, I guess.
Yeah, what fun. And speaking of like random connections, I was listening to another interview you gave, and you were mentioning St. Francis. What significance does St. Francis have for you? And then I'll tell you how that came up for me recently.
I'll try to be brief. We could do a podcast on my connection and the stories. So basically, as a child, my parents were pacifists, so they were against all war, and they came to that conclusion during the Second World War, interestingly. And so my father had this great reverence for St. Francis as a saint of peace, and although we were not Catholic, in fact, we were sort of boring Presbyterian, my father had this great reverence for St. Francis and for the prayer of St. Francis, which starts out, Lord, make me an instrument of thy peace. Mm. And I'm the youngest of five sons, and he wanted us to be peacemakers, not warriors. And so my father and I recited that prayer together many, many times as a child. So I will never forget that prayer. And so it had this impact as a child of a thing that my father and I did. It wasn't the Lord's Prayer he wanted me to know and recite. It was the prayer of St. Francis, which is all about compassion and forgiveness and peace and love. You know, it's very, very warm-hearted, to say the least. And later in life, I kind of never forgot that. And later in life, I was actually much, much later in life, in the 2010s, I was in Umbria, Italy, and discovered that where I was leading a workshop on heart math for health professionals was 10 miles from Assisi. St. Francis is often known as St. Francis of Assisi. That was his hometown. And it is now a giant shrine, a whole city dedicated to the life of St. Francis. And I was just down the road. Hmm. So I made the journey up there, and it's remarkable to be there, because not only is he buried there, there's a crypt down in sort of the basement of a huge cathedral. There are a number of cathedrals in the town, but the main one honoring him, I got to go downstairs to be there in the sarcophagus. And I was with my girlfriend at the time, and I said to her in advance, I said, so you already know I'm a very emotionally sensitive guy and I can cry. I am my last name, Cryer. crying is not hard for me. I said, I'll be down there. And this is a connection to my father. And my father had passed away 10 years earlier. This is a deep soul connection that I felt to the spirit of St. Francis my entire life. So I'm just letting you know, if I become a blubbering idiot, don't worry, I'm fine. a lot of it will be joy and like, exhilaration and magnificence and all these levels going on at the same time. And sure enough, that is what happened. And so that kind of deepened a connection to St. Francis that then has played out in countless ways. I mean, weird ways. Like when I was living in New York City for a while, I was like, what am I doing here? It's cold and gray and it's hard and edgy and, all this loud. And I'd be, kind of bemoaning my fate, and I'd look up and there was the St. Francis dry cleaners, or I'd be longing to have a connection with St. Francis. And I was driving through the Southwest and we were heading to Santa Fe. This was about 5 years, 6 years ago, 5 years ago, and longing to have this connection with St. Francis. And as we're pulling into Santa Fe, we discovered that the full name of Santa Fe has St. Francis in it, because this town was built to honor St. Francis. And the main cathedral in town is called the Cathedral of St. Francis. And the main hotel in town is called the Hotel of St. Francis. And so I woke up with this yearning for St. Francis, not knowing all that was waiting for us in Santa Fe, where we were going to arrive that night. So suddenly we're there for a few days, and I'm just like, St. Francis once again. And there was another, probably the most profound experience of all was, I was in Maui about 7 years ago at a wonderful event for this group that I was part of, still part of, called the Association of Transformational Leaders. And you and I were just talking about Preston Smiles, one of my dear friends who were both members of that group. And so it was a wonderful 4 or 5 day event, and pretty much everybody had left. I stayed on for another day, but before it ended, we were having our final event in a big ballroom, and it was very meditative, and so people came in two at a time and just sat there. The lights were dim. It was very kind of holy, sacred vibe, and candles and whatnot, and kind of interesting music playing in the background. I was sitting there meditating, and at one point I noticed this song, and as I was listening to the lyrics, I thought, this is the prayer of St. Francis. I wasn't crazy about the song, but the words were the prayer of St. Francis. And so as soon as that happened, it was like, I'm on high alert. Like something I need to pay attention. Something's about to happen. This isn't random that I'm hearing St. Francis prayer lyrics. But I didn't care for the song that much. I kind of just like, okay, just see what happens. The next song comes on by the same artist. It turned out to be the old lead guitarist of the Animals back in the 60s, mm-hmm. who had gone spiritual, was now living in Maui and in New Zealand. And he had this whole set of music with a Hawaiian flair. So the song after the St. Francis song was this gorgeous song, all in Hawaiian language, so I couldn't understand the words. But I was just sitting there, and suddenly there was a moment, I was just sitting there meditating. The song entered my heart. And I was like, what is going on? What just happened? And I felt this song, and this just tremendous love and gratitude was pouring out of me. And after the event ended, I went up to the guy running the sound system. I said, what was that song? Who was that artist? I got to find out. So anyway, I found out it was this artist named Antion, formerly lead guitarist of the Animals, a British rock group in the 60s. Get the album. For the next 72 hours, I did not stop playing that song. And it led me to this spiritual awakening down at the southern coast of Maui, to past life memories, to reconnecting with a soul that I had met in Maui hundreds of years ago when I had lived there as a European settler. All kinds of images came to mind. Whoa. And I just was in this kind of bubble, started because the St. Francis song, which wasn't the song I loved, woke me up to pay attention, something's about to happen. And then that next song came on, and that song just opened up this incredible portal into my soul. And I'll never forget it. I have a photo that I keep with me of the scene in Maui where I was standing when part of this kind of awakening was going on. The spirit of Maui speaking to me, saying, "Welcome home. We're glad you're back," kind of thing.
Wow.
Welcome home. Okay. So that was, again, sparked by St. Francis, and then just so many moments, too many to count, but where I'll be just driving, I'm just feeling a little down maybe, and then I look over, Franciscan Deli, whatever. And you don't even realize how much the name St. Francis shows up in life. Anything with the with friends. I lived near San Francisco for 40 years. Right. San Francisco, mm-hmm. Spanish for St. Francis. The city I was drawn to was the city of St. Francis. And I lived there for 40 years. So there's just so many examples. We don't even realize that the influence that St. Francis actually has in our language. Anything with the name Francis, anything with the name Francisco or Franciscan or, you know, whatever. So it's been a deep connection, to say the least.
Hmm. That's I need to go and learn a little bit about read his biography or something, because I don't know anything about him. I'm super curious about this past life memory in Maui. What do you think the significance of you tapping back into that was at that moment?
You know, I don't know ultimately what it has significance wise for me. I mean, I feel it's like a sacred home for me there. I would love to have a home there. I would love to have the ability to be there on a regular basis. Now I don't live very close. In California, at least, I was only 5 hours, 6 hours away. Now in Austin, it's that much harder. But I think it was one of those set of experiences that kind of validated whispering. I'm not the kind that tends to think about past lives at all. Occasionally I've had whispers of things and you know, it's like, okay, that might be true and it might not, but I don't feel like I have to kind of go there particularly. This set of experiences was so profound. It was just like, dude, what more evidence do you need than the fact that you cannot turn this song off for 72 hours, even to the point when I was flying home and I got upgraded for some reason to first class for the whole trip home from Maui to San Francisco, the city of St. Francis. I'm listening to the song again because I couldn't stop. You know, as soon as I had the chance to turn the music back on, I did, and I was meditating to it. And initially I'm feeling this, you know, tremendous upwelling of love and gratitude and just like, because the song is incredibly uplifting to me, maybe to nobody else, but it certainly was to me. But suddenly in the middle of this meditation, the joy and the exhilaration turns to grief, like searing grief that I could not get out of for a while. Mm. And finally, I was kind of putting the pieces together and realized I had been there hundreds of years ago. I had been a European settler, and later on, a psychic confirmed all of this for me in different ways.
Oh, cool.
That I became kind of a great man, like a governor of the island, but I was dedicated to maintaining the indigenous culture, not just Europeanizing everything. And I'd fallen in love with a young Maui woman, and then she died suddenly from a European-born disease.
Oh, geez.
And then she came back, she reincarnated and came back to me later, but the European mindset, not, that guy wasn't necessarily open like this guy is right now. I kind of rejected her because, of course, number one, she would now have been probably 30 years younger than me, and like that's not going to be cool if I'm a famous man or something. But anyway, I just couldn't handle it apparently. Hmm. So there had been sort of this yearning in me for a lifetime to reconnect, to kind of regret I had missed an opportunity, I'd upset her, whatever it was. Hmm. And I later met that person in real life.
In this lifetime?
In this life, yeah. And we had, it wasn't a great relationship, it turned out. But there was moments that were fantastic, and we had a very powerful connection to one another. But it was more like something had to complete that had been left incomplete back from all that time. So there were many facets to that experience, but I think one of the most profound is just trusting my intuition, trusting my heart feelings at a whole nother level. Because when I looked at what happened, how that story unfolded, first it was honoring, okay, St. Francis' prayer is playing right now. Pay attention, dude. And then I kind of got lost in a meditation, and suddenly the next song literally enters my heart. And you know, I'm super sensitive to music, so I have that happen. But when it happens, it's like, okay, this is a big moment. This is a benchmark moment in life that that music is literally entering my heart and giving me all these incredible feelings. So to honor that process and to be willing to surrender to that and just follow where it's going to take me, is something I think I've learned to do and trust more and more, deeper and deeper. And so now I'm just far more, when little signs show up, like Franciscan dry cleaners, it's like a wink from my soul, a wink from the divine, a wink from St. Francis, like, I got you, bro, you know? And so it's like, but allowing myself to acknowledge all that and to feel all that and to wink back, you know, I got you too, man. And
can you describe what it feels like when a song enters your heart?
Well, it varies depending upon the song. I in this case, when I was describing that, I was sitting there kind of listening to the second song, the one with the Hawaiian lyrics, that was beautiful, and so I was in kind of a reverie with it, and there was a certain chord movement that just like, oh, it just, now music can do that to me. I mean, I can just hear a certain chord transition, a chord progression, and it's like, Oh my God! That just the sense of yearning and longing and belonging that can all happen. And so this happens to me. I got one of those nervous systems. Plus, I've been into music since I was a kid. So deeply into music, you know, as a performer, as a lover of music. So I allow myself to be deeply moved by music, and I love that I can do that. I love that I get to experience that in this life, that music can move me in that way. So I open to it. I'm not like, oh, what's that? Like, oh, that makes me feel uncomfortable. It's like, oh, what is going on? So the entering, I mean, it literally feels like a physical sensation in the heart of kind of the dissolve. Sometimes it's like the dissolving of, it's both the feeling of deep joy or gratitude or magnificence, something along those lines, depending on the moment. But also with that, often the dissolving of whatever tension was keeping me from feeling that. So there's this both tears of like, oh, the release of whatever was the block that I wasn't probably conscious of, as well as the just surrendering into the utter joy and magnificence of the musician that has been able to bring in this music that I'm now listening to in this ballroom in Maui, you know? So it's like just all those elements at the same time that just kind of can overwhelm me in a good way. And I allow myself to be overwhelmed. I allow myself to cry, whatever, wherever it wants to take me. So I'm cool with it.
Yeah. Thank you for that. That's, you know, what I'm hearing is your training as a musician, as a performer, allows you to perceive and connect to music in sort of maybe more subtle or deeper ways. What I'm wondering is,
I'm a dancer too.
And a dancer.
And when I was coming back from the health issues I had for a couple of years and had to have double hip replacement, discovered I was able to dance again. And if I could work myself back into shape, I could dance as much as I wanted, because now I'm the guy with titanium hips. Watch out. as opposed to, oh, I'm the cripple. Oh, poor me. I had to have double hip replacement surgery. No, I've got titanium hips.
Amazing.
So I've discovered I could dance again. So the combination of the freedom I always have felt with dance since I was a late teenager, dance has moved me to tears many times if it's the right music. I'll be on the dance floor and just be like, oh my God. Oh my God. And then, but move through that. So because I'm a dancer and have done improv dance for decades, let alone more formal stuff, the sense of allowing myself, my whole physicality, to surrender to music. I love that that's been my path, that I'm free to feel it in my body and not, I don't have resistance to expressing it in my body and dancing in whatever way I'm moved to dance. So
you'll appreciate then that we do Friday morning dance parties here, me and my kids.
Awesome.
You know, put on whatever, whether it's techno or oldies or whatever, but it's fun to do. It's fun to do dance parties with them. I'm wondering if we can science-ify this, if there is any of the studies from HeartMath that are relevant to this concept of music entering your heart? If there's, or any particular concepts or frameworks of thinking about how the heart operates and guides us that, that may be relevant to like weave in here.
Well, on one level, you know, a lot of the core of HeartMath has been to help us humans understand how differently our bodies process different emotional states. So, you know, HeartMath is well known for its work around heart rate variability and showing that stressful emotions, whether that be anxiety, anger, overwhelm, depression, you know, aggression, whatever it may be, causes a chaotic rhythm in the heart. That's well established now, thanks to HeartMath 30 years ago. Conversely, also well established is that any positive emotional state, joy, appreciation, gratitude, fun, love, compassion, all of those produce like a sine wave in the heart, radically different than the chaotic rhythm in the heart produced by a stressful emotion. So music, some music, we early on in HeartMath, we studied a variety of styles of music and found that some music naturally tends to produce more of a coherent state no matter who the person is. But your preference does still matter. So in other words, for most people, loud heavy metal or, you know, techno with no harmony, that's just kind of like jackhammers, for most people, that will not put them into a coherent state. Some people are wired to love that so much that that would put them in a coherent state. So, but we did learn in general that classical music tends to produce more of a, in general, I mean, there's some classical that like to say classical music is like saying religion does X when there's so many religions and so many classical music forms and styles. But in general, it, because of the structure and the harmonies and whatnot, tends to produce a calming, coherent sort of effect. So does jazz in general, interestingly. But again, preference does matter. So if you really love something, you know how you feel in your body, and the heart rate variability monitor would confirm that. Yeah, Bruce is loving that Broadway show tune. Somebody else is saying Broadway. You got to be, that's so artificial, you know. But for Bruce, no, he's in heaven hearing that. So that's a lot of what I think HeartMath figured out, is that the level of appreciation we feel for anything when you. One of the things I first learned from the founder of HeartMath, before HeartMath even existed, like three or four years before, I was having a private meeting with him one night, and I was, you know, I knew he was all into the heart and studying the heart and wanting to set up an organization to really look into it much deeper. And I thought of myself at the time as kind of ex-actor, singer, dancer, more emotionally sensitive than the average guy. That's partly what drew me to that kind of a world, is it was fun to express different emotions, you know, through dance, through voice, through acting. And so I knew I was sort of more tuned in to some of those things than the average guy. But I also felt like I still know what this really means to be in your heart or follow your heart or any of that stuff. And one night I asked him, I said, so what is it? How do you know you're in your heart? It's kind of like what you said. What does it feel like when music goes into the heart? And his simple answer to me was, it feels like appreciation. And I pondered that, and I thought, every time I feel appreciation, it feels so good. You know, if somebody acknowledges me for something, and I'm grateful that they said that, or a kind gesture from someone, and I feel appreciation that they did that for me, that's a feeling here. I do feel it there in the heart. And so that simple comment was like, wow, for me, because I thought, oh, I can go to town with that, because I intuitively know appreciation matters in life about everything. If you appreciate a relationship, it grows. If you appreciate money, it grows. If you appreciate a garden, you care for it, you tend it. You know, so all these aspects where appreciation clearly matters. So I've followed that principle for more than 30 years, but little by little over the years, and especially in the aftermath of going through 2 years of a couple life-threatening conditions, at the same time my mother passed away, at the same time my marriage was ending, at the same time I was having these kind of existential questions of my role in HeartMath, and finally concluding I needed to move to the next phase and step down as CEO, which I was at the time of the for-profit side. And so all this was kind of bubbling in me at the same time, but I was honoring the deeper feelings in myself more and more, honoring the grief, honoring the, and not just saying, oh, I got to get coherent right away. It was more like, no, you're going through a lot of stuff. It's okay to feel all of it. It's okay. You'll get through this. And so I kind of allowed myself to do that. And so I start to see as time went on that my heart was opening even more to experience in general. And so I think that's when, I mean, I always knew that music had the power to move me. But in the last 10 or 12 years, since I went through all that, it's at a whole nother octave of impact. A freaking song of a commercial could get me to tears. If it has a certain mood, I'll be wide open for it, not intending to be, but I'll just think, damn, that just got me. So I don't know if that's a kind of a circuitous answer to your question, but there's levels and layers to it. But I have to acknowledge my parents in two ways. My father, as I already mentioned, he was a pacifist, as was my mother. At a time when that wasn't a popular concept, my father was a farm boy from Ohio, growing up in the Depression, left the family farm in a battle over with his dad, who wanted him to run the farm. And my dad said, I'm not doing it. I'm going off to put myself through college. So honoring him, but he was very open to music. He was a great singer himself who never did it professionally, but had a beautiful voice. And he could be, is that when I was a young kid, he'd be sitting in his chair on a Sunday after we'd come home from church and had Sunday dinner, and he'd put on a Mahler symphony or a Verdi opera or some great music, because he was quite a student of great music. And sometimes he'd be sitting there just like imagining he was Leonard Bernstein conducting the New York Philharmonic and literally conducting. But there'd be times when there was tears streaming down his face. He was just so moved by the music. And for a young boy, it was kind of like, I don't know quite how to process that. I wasn't afraid of my father. I just couldn't quite, he's crying because of the Verdi opera. Okay. I just couldn't quite process it. I just didn't have the emotional wiring yet to fully process it. He was also a very affectionate man. He hugged a lot, was very open about hugging and very open about telling me he loved me. And I'm still so grateful to have had a father that was so open that he could surrender to music and surrender to his son or a new person that he was meeting and just be so delighted by that person. And I thought, wow, what a gift this is to have been raised by such a man. So I add that in this whole conversation because, and my mother was as well. He was more demonstrative and he was the singer. My mother was more the playful one who was the artist. They both had day jobs that were like totally straight. He worked for a life insurance company in Manhattan and like did the commute on the train and with the huddled masses going to work every day. Uh-huh. My mother was a school teacher, but their hearts were open to being delighted by beauty, whether that could be art or color or nature or music. They were open to that. And so I lived in such an environment. I'm so fortunate that this life, that was how I was kind of guided. So I've just accepted, okay, that's why I'm here. Pretty obvious, based on the parents, based on the gifts that I have, the talents that I've been able to develop. This is who I am, so.
Yeah, you're making me think of what my own kids must think of me. It's kind of an interesting thought experiment, because I'm sort of hyper aware of like my influence on them and just wondering, what direction that would send them in, or like when I like say something, I know that I'm programming them to some degree, so it's just, but I had the same experience the other day. My daughter was home sick and she fell asleep on my lap on the couch. And I was just like, sitting there just appreciating how sweet and wonderful she is. And I started crying. I was like, oh my gosh, I'm just like in my house alone crying about my daughter's wonderfulness.
Awesome. Awesome,
It was
man.
nice.
Awesome. I think more men need to do that. I mean, I think more and more men, not as many in my generation, unfortunately, but more guys your generation and younger are more open to that, I think, than ever. I think society has gradually shifted more into guys got to get their act together and feel and not keep blocking it. And part of the irony, and I've said this hundreds of times when I've taught heart math workshops, is how the 6'5", 350-pound linemen have no problem saying, "I love my guys. You know, I'd go to war for these guys." You know, and have no problem using the love word, and expressing emotion and being choked up by something that one of the teammates did on their behalf. But most guys in a business setting, they're not going to go. They're not going to go there. That feels threatening. It feels, well, why would you be vulnerable and expose your, you know, really? Have you noticed what football coaches do? Have you noticed what football players do? Why is it okay for them? For soldiers who hang out in the trenches and they have this deep love for each other, the brother, why is that not accessible to all of us? Of course it is, but why do we tell ourselves, no, that's not okay? So.
I'm curious. So you mentioned this conversation with this guy before the founding of HeartMath. I'm wondering if you could sort of walk us through like how HeartMath came to be. I think founding stories are pretty interesting, and I've been having lots of conversations recently of people with like they're starting something right now. They're in this phase where they're like, I received this vision. Or I can't get this idea out of my head. Like I feel like I have to do this thing. So yeah, I'm curious like how it started and how you became involved.
We got a few hours, right, to discuss this. I'm smiling because the version I will tell, other people that were even closer to him at the time he was having different awakenings and insights would have another version that might be somewhat different than the one that when I kind of came in and met the man. But Doc Childree is the name of the founder of HeartMath. I first met him in 1980, and he was kind of traveling through California where I was living, and I was part of a kind of a spiritual community that also had some businesses. We ended up being the first company to bring spirulina to the United States back when spirulina became a big deal in the early 80s. We were the first ones. So there were all these enterprises as well as this kind of core spiritual group, and he was fascinated by it. So he'd come through and was visiting. And I met him one night and I said, "So where are you staying?" And he said, "Well, I don't know. I actually have a place to stay tonight." I said, "Well, my girlfriend and I, we've got a motor home on our property. You're welcome to stay there. It's next to our house." And he stayed there a few days. I hung out with him and had really interesting conversations. And I had the experience of, so I grew up in the New York area and, you know, somewhat academic family, very Northeast. So influenced by, you know, Ivy League and New York and, you know, all those mindsets. And to encounter someone with as thick a Southern accent as Doc Childree had set off all the must be redneck, must be stupid, must be a racist, you know, unconscious kind of assumptions about him. As I started talking to him, I thought, this is the most caring, intuitive man I've ever met in my life. And whatever about anything else, I can't sense any of that. Of my stereotype, all I feel is, damn, he's tuned in and sensitive and kind of awesome. But this was 1980, so there was no way to really stay in touch. I didn't see him again for 6 years. There was no, we didn't have cell phones then. We didn't have email then. We didn't have all the things that are so taken for granted now. And so he reappeared, so to speak, around 80, late 86, 80, early 87, right around the time my daughter was also being born. And he, when I saw him again, it was in the context of a number of people there were seeing him. He'd come back out to California, and he was like, seemed like a kind of a bigger guy by this point, not physically bigger, but just more presence and more like there's something going on that he's got some things in mind. And that's when we started talking more about the heart, and it was clear as I started to kind of piece together aspects of his background, he had kind of had an awakening kind of during the 60s, as did so many of our generation. He was about 10 years older than me. But at a certain point, he had this very powerful sense after doing, after exploring many spiritual and health practices, you know, from charismatic Christianity to Gurdjieff to vegetarianism to breatharianism to, you know, he just tried all kinds of things. And what he would tell later was that he was always looking for the cream, the nugget. What's the essence I can get out of this? He didn't want to be identified with any one of the things, but he's like, what's the thing that's making this thing really alive for me? And invariably, the thing that he would take was the heart. Wherever there was heart in those things, that's what he would want to hang on to. And then as time went on, he started to notice a job that I'm good at is because I put my heart into it. A relationship that I work hard for is because my heart's in it. If my heart's gone out of a job, I lose interest. I'll probably quit. If my heart's gone out of a relationship, it's not going to work because my heart's not in it. He started having these insights about the heart, how important it was, and how in Western society we were calling it a pump. Mm-hmm. And like, that's it. Like, and yet every parent says, go play with your heart. Go just get up there and just sing with your heart. It's going to be fine. Are we saying, just go out there and play with your pump? Just put that pump in. Of course not. We're saying something much deeper than that, that there's a core here. So I was kind of picking that up from him in these early conversations. And in early conversations now, this is like 1987. And then things start to evolve. And the group that I was connected to in California, and he and some of his friends, he was based in North Carolina at the time, were starting to interact more. And there was more and more like, I think we're supposed to work together somehow, somewhere. And just things kind of kept evolving. Luckily, I was living in the town in the Bay Area of California in a redwood forest where he wanted to be. And so by 1990, things had evolved significantly. An organization was in the process of forming, and he, with about 15 people, gradually moved out from North Carolina. So we would set up a property which became the original HeartMath Research and Training Center, and still is the HeartMath Research and Training Center 30 years later. So that was 1990 that the kind of solid formation with land and about 30 people all were coming together in this place in the Santa Cruz Mountains of the Bay Area of California. And HeartMath officially started in 1991 when we received our nonprofit designation as a 501c3 nonprofit research and education institute. And but it was formed from people who had been part of that kind of spiritual community in California, others from Los Angeles, others from North Carolina. So it was kind of a melding of three sets of people, all fascinated with this idea of building a system around the heart based in science. And that was one of the biggest things that attracted me, actually, because, you know, the joke I've made a zillion times is, like, the world needed another self-help system from California. But what the world was lacking was a scientifically based system using mainstream medical and scientific methods, not alternative methods. I'm not against alternative methods, but if you want to try to prove something to mainstream using alternative methods that they haven't validated, well, good luck with that. If you try to prove something to mainstream using mainstream methods, they're going to buy into it because they'll look at your research and say, you've done your homework. There's something here. So we got published in major medical journals. We did plenty of alternative stuff too, but we got into the Journal of the American College of Cardiology. We got into Preventive Cardiology, major heart disease journal. We got into Stress Medicine, a major medical journal. Got into Harvard Business Review. You can't get much more mainstream than that. And we only got there because the research was so solid and kind of a pretty unassailable by mainstream skeptics. Mm-hmm. And I'm very proud of the fact that we did that. And I and HeartMath get honored all the time for, wow, the work you guys did back in the early days to validate alternative ideas, spiritual ideas, through using hard science. And I'm very glad. And that, again, that was a big attractor for me in the early days, was we wanted to make an impact in all segments of society, not just to the spiritually oriented people. We wanted to be able to work in the military, work in government, work in schools, work in churches, and say, this is a system. If you learn to follow your heart, there's a scientific approach to this. It doesn't have to freak you out. It doesn't have to weird you out. It doesn't have to feel like this is Satan talking right now. This is science. and
it's such an interesting like why should peer-reviewed science be the doorway into somebody to, like, people probably know this stuff already, but it's like, we're going to validate it for you and then you can trust it. I rely on the same things. Like when I find useful papers in quantum physics or about hypnosis or whatever that like backs up, you know, some esoteric concept that I'm playing around with, it's great. Like when I talk to my dad, for example, who is a lifelong scientist, like I can be like, here's the papers that back up this concept, hoping that they'll accept it more or like look into it a little bit more or try to use it. But I am also hoping that like maybe we can move past that a little bit, because I still think it's hard to move forward as a society when we keep relying on like, show me the data before I believe something, even if they know it to be true already.
Well, I think things are changing. I mean, I look at the receptivity to wellness in general now and all kinds of spiritual concepts now. Mindfulness was not a thing 30 years ago when HeartMath started. I mean, yes, it existed in pockets, but it wasn't a mainstream thing where you could use it casually and feel like most people in most parts of the world are going to be okay with that term. That wasn't the case 33 years ago when HeartMath was starting. So COVID was one of the silver linings of COVID was an acceptance of wellness principles, and not just saying you got to have proof. Like, what more proof do we need that social isolation is not a good idea? What more proof do we need other than COVID kind of showing us? I mean, I, for one, I think it was four consecutive Christmases without family.
Mm.
And part of that was I'm on the other side of the country, but so some of it was just not too easy. But then it was also like, well, no, Dad, I can't see you. I'm in a pod. I'm immunocompromised. I can't see anybody right now. And so the social isolation, and I was chose to, because of a job, to move away from a core group of close friends and family also. My point being, the experience of social isolation for billions of people made it really obvious, man, that stuff matters. We didn't have to see the data,
mm-hmm.
right? I think that's just one example of how a lot of that has eased. But I think our strategy was, if we're going to make an impact in society, the leaders, I mean, yeah, they do stuff on their gut all the time, but they got to justify it to somebody usually. And few leaders are going to go out on a limb without a date. They may intuitively know, I want to do this HeartMath thing. I don't care if there's data. But the fact that we could give them data, help them convince the CFO that this is a good idea.
Mm-hmm.
Or the CIO or the COO, right? So it was a strategy in part to be able to effect significant change, systemic change. You got to talk in the language that the leaders of those organizations, who are chosen largely for their left brain, analysts, data people, they're driving results. You know, that mindset is still there. That hasn't diminished. Look at Wall Street. Look at how most companies are run. It's all about profit and numbers and everything else. But it is gradually changing. And I mean, even for HeartMath, there were plenty of people over the years that were like, okay, guys, I get it on the research. You can stop talking about the research now. Can we please just do a meditation? Yeah, there'd be plenty of people who are like, guys, you really got the research now. And we said, yeah, it's cool. Isn't it cool? Don't you like it? I said, no, it's okay. You know, it's okay. I don't need that. We'd say, that's cool. And I'll shut up with the science right now. You want to meditate? Close your eyes. Let's do it. You know, so it's always been a balancing act. And I think I was just saying this to somebody the other day about the number of people who revere HeartMath because of the science and kind of amazed that such an obviously spiritual system, spiritually oriented system, heart-based system, was so scientific, kind of amazed that we had figured out a way to do it both. And I said, yeah, but there definitely have been plenty who were who wish we weren't quite so scientific in the style, you know. So
you guys had the science branch and the training branch. I know there's lots of corporate trainings and you gave lots of presentations and you were the CEO. So could you tell me a little bit about the model what I'm imagining is like there's some profit side that funds the science that allows it to keep going, you know, the mission to keep being funded. How did that all sort of work or was architected?
Yeah, so one of the interesting aspects of HeartMath, so it started as a nonprofit, as I said. We had in the group some for-profit businesses already that were sort of helping to fund the institute initially. But we wanted the nonprofit because we wanted donors. We wanted to be able to get grants. We wanted to appeal to foundations and whatnot. But after about 6 years, we realized as we were starting to get into looking into technology and IP and whatnot, that to have only a nonprofit structure was a bit limiting commercially. And however, all of us who were running the Institute were all from the for-profit world. So we thought like business people, not like nonprofit people. So we were always thinking as an Institute of programs we could develop and sell, products we could develop and sell, because you can do that as a nonprofit. It's not like you can't, but everything's structured differently inside a nonprofit. You can't be making profit per se. That's why you get to not pay tax, right? Your motivation can't be to make profit. It's for the public good, for the public benefit. So, but at a certain point, we felt to really expand and reach more people in more situations. For example, when we were only a nonprofit, and I would go to certain corporations, and they would find out that I was, you know, a leader in a nonprofit, they'd say, "Well, you don't understand our world. You're a nonprofit." And so I would not have the respect of certain people in certain places because, oh, nonprofit's a totally different mindset. And to some degree, that was true. So in 1998, we set up a new company called HeartMath LLC, which was a for-profit side. So these were two companies sharing a name, which has created confusion for all these years. HeartMath Institute, the nonprofit. HeartMath, now it's HeartMath Inc., the for-profit. Sharing a logo, just to add further confusion, but separate legally and had to be separate because there was no way you could maintain the nonprofit structure and all the benefits that come with being a nonprofit if they're still too intertwined, right? Mm-hmm. So two separate businesses. So there'd be licensing agreements back and forth and legal separation of things. But the for-profit was set up so we could kind of run with things more and develop technology and not have it only inside a nonprofit and be able to get investors, not just donors, and be able to have more certain kinds of alliances that were more appropriate for a for-profit business than a nonprofit. And I found, because I was one of the three executives of the LLC when it was set up, that as soon as it was a for-profit in certain business settings or at Stanford Business School, suddenly I'm running a for-profit business, not a nonprofit. So now I'm one of the guys. Now I'm one of the, I'm like the other executives. So it just afforded different possibilities. So basically, HeartMath, the for-profit side, was the one creating technology, and actually it had a division too that was kind of specialized in that. But all that was sold through the for-profit side. And then we did all the work with corporations, and I was heading up that, and healthcare systems, and I was heading up all that. And then we had a very active direct-to-consumer business of books we were publishing and technology products more and more. And back in the day when you had CDs and DVDs and all that, we were developing all those kind of things. The nonprofit had some of the same products, and they had some of the same consumer. They also had a direct-to-consumer business because that was okay. But they focused on research. The nonprofit did. That made sense to be in the nonprofit, obviously. And they tended to focus on educational systems who often had very low budgets. And so sometimes the schools needed grants to get a HeartMath program into their school or their university or whatever. So just the nonprofit of HeartMath Institute has donors. 1 year, I was very involved in this project. It was in the early 2000s, because the second George Bush was the president, and No Child Left Behind was the big phrase in American education. And so test taking was the thing, you know, like that's kind of all that the big people cared about was our kids scoring well on tests. And so now it's kind of really, really, that's all that matters. And
very Cold War mentality.
Yeah, exactly. But then that's kind of what we were dealing with. So if we thought, well, if we're going to get any ways to validate what we're doing and how this can benefit kids, we're going to have to go somewhat down that route, or schools won't have the money to dedicate to hard math because that's where the money was, right? So we pitched Congress on a program to study test anxiety among high school age kids, and we actually hired a lobbying firm in D.C. who were way too expensive for us, and they offered a deal to us, and they said, we want our entire staff of our office, 35, 40 people, to go through HeartMath training. We want to be coached in it, our senior partners and the people doing the work on your behalf. We want to learn this. We want to be able to speak to Congress from our experience of using it ourselves, working with our families, and being able to say to a congressperson, we're not just hired lobbyists. We're using this stuff. We are seeing the benefits in our families, in our health, etc. So I was the guy sent out to do all that training. So I was many trips to D.C., sitting in a major, lobbying firm, thinking, wow, this is a picture I never saw for my life. But excited too that we were kind of cracking through the density of 3D reality, and it worked. And Congress gave us a $1 million grant. And it led to a major project in a couple of high school districts in California, to study test anxiety in kids and show the correlation between their physiology, and specifically heart rate variability, and anxiety, and their ability to score well on tests. And sure enough, we could teach kids how to regulate their heart rate variability, which really means regulate their nervous system. And that resulted in a smoother, more healthy rhythm in their heart, which promotes better cognitive functioning and skill, and the kids' test scores went up. Even kids didn't have test anxiety because they were learning how to regulate the rhythm of their heart. That improves brain function. They were scoring better, even though they didn't have an anxiety problem to begin with. But the kids with more anxiety, the anxiety went down and the test scores were going up. So it was a couple hundred page study. It's actually on the HeartMath Institute website. TENDS, TENS, Test Edge National Demonstration Study. That's the name of it. That's the acronym for it. So, we
So I
were
don't
able to get it.
remember Congress like saying like, all right, everyone, if we really want our test scores to come up, like here's what we need to do. Like we figured this out. Did that ever happen or what?
Well, I mean, a study came out, and back in the day, that 20, it must be 20 years ago now, a press release went out. But like anything, there can be some useful data and a well-funded study, well-done study, but it's back then it kind of got a bit lost in the all the noise of the world. This wasn't too much after 9/11. I think it was kind of still in that time period. So, new ideas take a while to catch on. I think the credibility of that study helped HeartMath tremendously, because it allowed them to have curricula specifically around test anxiety, which all during the 2000s and 2010s was still a big deal. And I think they still have that, because recently at the university where I'm working now, Salem University, one of the deans recently said to me, "Do you guys have anything for test anxiety?" I said, "Funny you should ask. Yeah, there's a whole major study that was funded by Congress that and a curriculum around test anxiety. So it's still a big issue for kids, because if you want to be a doctor, if you want to be a lawyer, if you want to be something that requires clear, measurable intelligence, you got to get good at tests, and but more importantly than that, you got to learn how to regulate your system so you're not, restricted by anxiety and you're feeling overwhelmed by such things.
I don't know if you saw this, but ChatGPT, the AI, recently passed, I believe it was a law school exam. And so
Yes, I
the
did.
okay. So the question is, as AI progresses, it's gonna seem really smart, and it's maybe gonna outcompete the thinking if we just isolate the thinking part of our system. But then there's all this potential. There's no way an AI can replicate intuition or accessing the heart. What do you think is the opportunity here that AI is presenting us to look at for humanity?
Well, so I was talking to a guy, a podcaster, the other day who told me he was all in on ChatGPT, and he said in the previous 12 days, ChatGPT had written 5 3,000-word articles for him on various topics around personal development and business and whatnot. 5 3,000-word articles. I mean that, and each one took 10 minutes between the time he put in all the parameters of what he needed. Within 10 minutes, it may have been 5 minutes, he had a 3,000-word article. Now then he then edited it and added some personalization so that it would sound like him and not just, you know, a well-done essay without personality. But, I mean, that's a great example of what is part of the revolutionary promise of these kinds of technologies, is that you can get a ton of work done and of a very high quality, very intelligently done and well-referenced and on and on and on when that's needed in an incredibly short amount of time for virtually nothing. And so that's a very appealing for a lot of business people. Somebody like me, I'm writing all the time, suddenly like, okay, that has some appeal. I could be generating an awful lot of content on a regular basis. I would still want to do something. I wouldn't want to just use ChatGPT as though it were me. I would want to at least personalize things and whatnot. But I can imagine as an entrepreneur, as a business person, that there's a lot of appeal for that kind of thing. However, to your point, it's not doing intuition. It's not emotionally sensitive. It's not helping me relate to other people better or be more compassionate for other people better. Or I was reading a passage in a book today by the theologian from the early 20th century, Emmett Fox, about the language of the Lord's Prayer, Our Father, that Christ was very specific, that inclusive, like our, meaning every frickin' one of us on the planet has a common father, or however you want to, they would have called it that in those days, and I don't think of it as father now, but the point being, we're all in this together. So that means sensitivity to people who think exactly opposite to us and look exactly different from us and do things in their lifestyle that rubs us totally the wrong way or shocks us. But we're all one humanity. And so that, I think that AI is not helping us get closer to that necessarily. I mean, maybe there's some applications that we'll try to do that. I'm not saying all that AI is helping us write articles in lightning speed. I think there's all kinds of applications that are interesting, but to me it's, and I think you saw the interview I did with Leila Salvade for Standing Light on this great question, why heart intelligence, I think we called it, why activating heart intelligence matters in the dawn of AI, that AI is not enabling us to be more intelligent or developing our wisdom or developing our intuition. It's not doing any of that. It may be saving us a lot of time from not doing other things that take a lot of time and take a lot of mind to do. So if that is the case, if you're combining ChatGPT with more heart meditation, you know, so you continue to develop yourself and can put certain functions and tasks on autopilot that you don't have to tend time to, awesome. And that's one level of it, I think, is that let's keep sight of what this is and what it isn't. The greatest power in the world's inside us, and few of us really put that as the main focus, because business demands our attention, or you know, whatever the issues are, and we lose sight of, or don't even believe that's true. So I will always be, well, you got to put the heart first, because we are humans with hearts, and that's where in my personal experience the where the music enters me. That's where I feel the presence of the divine. I call it God. I'm fine calling it God. I wasn't for 65 years. Now I'm fine. So anyway, it's
yeah,
cool.
Yeah,
it's cool.
Good callback to that entering the heart reference. Here's a concept that I encountered in Robin Kimmerer's Braiding Sweetgrass book, which I read last year. And it's something that comes up to me a lot. This concept, so you mentioned Our Father who art in heaven, and the our meaning all of us. And I think it's so interesting. Previous to last year, I would have thought all of humanity is in this together. But one thing that Native American languages do is that they personify trees and rocks and animals, and that's a person, like Mr. Tree, Mr. Fox. And so when you change the languaging, you change the concept of us together. Us is like all the things of the universe are people too. And it's just this expanded concept of like, we're all in this together, all across the board in a way.
Everything. Yeah. I agree. Thank you.
No, I wasn't trying to correct you there. I was curious to get your take on that concept, because, for example, I was listening to an interview, a podcast about the importance of beavers and how important they are to the water cycle and to fertilizing the soil and replenishing aquifers and maintaining habitats. They're basically terraforming, you know, the land to provide so much benefit. But there's also an interconnectivity piece there. There's like a inextricable linkage between all these things that's manifest in seeing how these beavers impact every part of the world.
Exactly.
And so there's this concept of like, we're all people, all things are people, and there's an interconnectedness between all things. That's when you try to separate them, like with science, if you try to examine one piece, right, you're by nature pushing out as much as you can to focus on the data for this one little thing, but there's influence of everything on the one thing.
You said it well. I get in my car, which is a little SUV hybrid, and I talk to it. And I maintain that there's consciousness in everything. Whether there's self-consciousness in everything, there is. That's not the case, that there's not necessarily self-consciousness. A rock doesn't know it's a rock. A car doesn't know it's a car. An insect may not know it's an insect. But whereas a lot of other species, humans, that's one thing that makes us pretty obviously different. There is a sense of self and a sense of something going on inside here. But my simple-minded thinking is that in my view, the divine, God, source, universe, whatever you want to call it, it's all that. Everything is that. There's no separating from the creator, the all that is. And therefore, in my opinion, even though things are clearly done by humans in free will that doesn't seem to be connected to the divine at all, and it seems all about hate and violence and murder and profit and, you know, self-centeredness, it's still, you know, God kind of figured out, well, that's going to happen. that's kind of part of the journey for humans is you go through the complete utter separation of complete denial that you're anything but yourself. That the complete oblivion to the fact that you're just part of something much bigger. Try to separate yourself. You can try, and people have been, and that's where wars start, and that's where people do all kinds of awful things. But it's all one consciousness, kind of any way you look at it. So I extend that to inanimate objects. Like, why not? Because in my mind, and my car does occasionally kind of blink back at me. Like, I'll get in the car. Like, I drove down to Austin. It was a 1,700-mile journey from New Jersey, where I was staying. And I get in the car for the first day, and I said, hey, buddy, road trip. and, you know, if somebody had been in the car with me, like, did you just say, hey, buddy, road trip to the car? I said, yeah, I do, because I care for the car. And this has been the most amazing car. It's a Lexus SUV I've ever had. It's like, it's completely trouble-free. It's completely reliable. It's completely comfortable. It's like, I love this car. And I tell it I love it on a regular basis. And every now and then I'll be driving and think, wait a minute, I have not said anything to the car for hours. What happened? Where did I go? And people can say, man, this guy's totally lost it. He's just way on some other, he's been smoking something too much. But in my view, we're all connected. It's all part of one universe. So why wouldn't I love something that appears to be inanimate? I'm not trying to prove that the car is really talking to me. I don't need to prove that to anybody. I maintain a loving relationship with inanimate objects all the time. And And I believe they are all products of consciousness. So who's to say there's not some consciousness in it if it's produced by consciousness? How do we know there's no consciousness in it? How are we so certain?
Yeah.
But I don't care if anybody believes that. Everybody can say he has completely lost it now. But that's okay. I'm totally fine with that.
So you dropped little nuggets of, you took this road trip, you were in New Jersey, now you're down in Austin. You're working with, I can't remember the name of the institution, university.
Salem University.
So I'm curious, and I think people may be wondering, you were involved in HeartMath for a long time. What are you up to currently?
Yeah, it's an interesting picture right now. So my primary job is I'm executive director of what's called the Integrative Health Institute at Salem University. And this is a new branch of a small university that I've founded. There was a school that I was the CEO of called the Graduate Institute for Holistic Studies, which was a small nonprofit graduate school up in Connecticut. And I was brought in during COVID to take over CEO, and it was struggling a lot. I mean, COVID was hard on every institution of higher education, and this small nonprofit in Connecticut, only registered, only accredited in Connecticut, was especially challenged. And so we were able to find a partner that was interested in the work that the Graduate Institute did, and so they acquired the assets of the institute back in a year ago, almost exactly a year ago, and I had to go into the new institution. I mean, I was happy to, but it was part of the deal. I had to. I couldn't leave. I had to come over because I've got a long background in holistic integrative, more than 40 years professionally. And so so that all started about a year ago, and we're kind of getting some good things going now. And but my role is not, I don't need to live any place specific for this job. Because most of our programs for the institute that we're developing are online anyway, and so school has a campus in West Virginia, where they have several hundred students and have several hundred more students online, all over the world. There was no place I had to be, so I could live kind of anywhere. So once that sale happened about a year ago, I kind of started thinking, and I was for a while back in New Jersey, living with some great people and enjoying a very picturesque part of New Jersey. But then I was like, okay, I'm really free now. I can be kind of where I want. And I was drawn to Austin for a variety of reasons, especially friends, a number of friends that had moved here over the last several years, a lot who came here during COVID. Also, it seemed like it would be warmer here than the Northeast. Of course, we just came out of 4 days of an intense ice storm. So much for the warmer. But it'll be 70 on Monday,
good.
On Sunday. So warmth is returning. But I was just drawn to come down here. I was intrigued because, so many people that I highly value and are very creative people, entrepreneurs and artists and whatnot, it's always been known as kind of a relatively innovative place for Texas and more, art scene, music scenes. I was always kind of intrigued by that. But then when all these friends started pouring down here, I thought, okay, I got to come down and check it out. So that's what brought me down here. And I came with the idea that I'm open to exploring what life has in store next. I'm still working with the university, but they know that there's a big part of me that a university can't kind of hold, that doesn't fit in an academic institution fully. So they understand that. So in addition to helping build this Integrative Health Institute, I continue to teach. So I teach courses on creativity online. I teach this course on creativity I built 6 years ago for Stanford. I still teach it for Stanford online for their employee wellness program. I mentor entrepreneurs, especially entrepreneurs and people in business who are in big life change moments, career change moments. And they look at me and they said, you seem to have been able to reinvent yourself any number of times. I said, yeah, it kind of looks like I'm addicted to it, doesn't it? But it's true, I have. And so people often kind of want to work with me one-on-one because they're kind of evaluating, I've been doing this job for a long time. It doesn't feel like my calling anymore. And I'm not quite sure what the next step is. So I do some of that work one-on-one. And, but I'm kind of into a mode of what else do I want to do? And you know, as I was mentioning to you earlier, I'm doing a lot of podcasts right now, and which is super fun. I love having conversations with interesting people, and I feel like I probably want to do my own. And that's now that I'm doing a lot of interviews, it's like, yeah, I should be doing this. As I should be the interviewer as well, not just the one being, you know, talked to.
Oh, interesting.
And so I feel like I'd love to do that, you know. And but I also I've never stopped loving heart math. So there's a significant project that I'm a partner in Dubai, which will be bringing heart math and various wellness modalities, hopefully the work of Dr. Joe Dispenza, to audiences in Dubai, corporate healthcare, et cetera. And that's a project I'm in the midst of. And also looking at different places. I love teaching. I'm surprised that I like online teaching as much as I do, but when that's all you've got, you kind of learn to love it or not. And if you don't love it, then you don't keep doing it. But I found out, even though it's a little screen, I have to be alive. And I think people actually like that because we've spent so many thousands of hours online over the last few years, especially that if there's somebody that's actually alive and not just, you know, smart at their topic, you know, it's different. And so I found that I like this medium. I prefer to be with people. Trust me. I way prefer to be with people dancing and singing and sitting down over a cup of coffee or whatever. But when this is the best option for various reasons, hey, let's make it work. So my life's got a lot of different facets to it. And when I was living closer to New York, one of the greatest joys of living there was I was performing a lot in the city. So I never kind of stopped being a singer. And, you know, that was my first career in New York years and years ago. And so there's a group I perform with in Manhattan. It's an event we do called Peaceable Hour. And it's for classically trained musicians. I'm classically trained, even though I moved more into musical theater and more pop stuff. And we perform a range of types of songs in a chapel of a church, which is also a theater in New York. And it's an hour of gorgeous music, no applause, no money. You can't donate to us. We have no way of accepting your money. So it's
There is an
just for
audience.
music. There's an audience. Yeah. It's
Okay.
small. It could be 5 people. It could be 50. It's 15. We're like shocked. Wow. Wow. We're
Yeah.
full tonight. It's a little chapel in a church in Manhattan. But the joy of it is that, and the whole purpose of it is, you can't be in Manhattan for a day and not be stressed out. Pretty much. I mean, just the noise. If you live there, you kind of adapt to it, but you know, just moving around the city, it's tiring, right? And so we said, let's have an event every week or two for 1 hour. You just get to sit and bathe in beautiful music performed by super talented musicians, and that's all. Just sit there and love it, or not, or just rest. If you don't like the song, just rest. So we're there to just create peace. Now I'm in Austin. I don't have that outlet at the moment. I'll probably migrate back to the New York area for a period of time because I love to be able to still sing and share with people that in that way.
I feel like there's a, you know, I play Ultimate Frisbee, and almost any city you go to, there's a pickup game you can just find and join. I feel like there's got to be like pickup music similar thing.
You know, I'm sure there is. I'm sure there is. You know, there are probably people right now listening to this in Austin saying, "Dude, there's
Sending
all
you a
kinds of
message.
stuff here." I just haven't looked into it. Yeah, actually, you just made it come. I have to give this anecdote. It's a fun little anecdote that is not on my resume. I played in the first interscholastic Ultimate Frisbee game in 1970.
Really?
Ultimate Frisbee was actually created. The guy who has always been given the credit for this is a Hollywood film producer named Joel Silver, who for a period of about 3 years was one of my closest friends back in college years. And he grew up in South Orange, New Jersey. I grew up in Millburn, New Jersey, two adjacent towns. And the South Orange High School, called Columbia High School, is where Ultimate Frisbee started. And they that Joel invented the game. If you look on Joel's website, he's a film producer who did the Die Hard movies, the Matrix movies, the Lethal Weapons movies, Sherlock Holmes. He's done a crazy set of movies as a producer. On his bio, you will see one of the things he's the proudest of is he was the original creator of Ultimate Frisbee.
Whoa.
So the first actual game between two high schools was my school, Milburn, against Joel's school, Columbia High, played in a parking lot in South Orange, New Jersey, which had a deep ravine off one side of the parking lot. So this is like the most dangerous possible place to play Ultimate Frisbee. We got creamed. We lost like 40-7. I mean, it was like some ridiculous score because we'd never played before. We were just a bunch of guys.
You're like, we're the inventors. Like, who knows the game other better?
School. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So we got totally creamed. But yeah, so whenever I hear Ultimate Frisbee, I thought, I have an interesting connection to that. It was 1970. I think it was spring of 1970. I was in that, the first interscholastic game in South Orange, New Jersey.
Wow. And Ultimate Frisbee really is a, I see it as a representative game of like a shift in consciousness, because there's no referees and the primary codified like rule is spirit of the game. Like that's the first thing, is it's like we are kind to each other. Like there's no contact. We're playing for the joy of it. It's like men and women are equal on teams, mixed teams. And it's like such a new, it's a fantastic game, but like the framework for like how you bring new people in and teach them like what this is about is different than so many other games and sports.
That's awesome to hear. I haven't played it in years. Mm-hmm. Titanium hips running on hard surfaces is not something I should be doing on a regular basis, but
we moved off of parking lots. We don't play on parking lots anymore.
Well, yes, I do understand that is a relic of its tainted past, I loved it for similar reasons that you're describing when back then when I was playing it, because it did have this very kind of fun, spontaneous, egalitarian kind of vibe. But I'm sure back then this was just a bunch of high school kids playing pickup, and they'd been doing it longer in Maplewood, and they had some basic framework, and so that was it. There wasn't much of a philosophy, but now it's 50 years later. It's lovely to hear how it's evolved and the spirit of it now.
Amazing. What fun. Yeah, I feel like this is a great place maybe to wrap our conversation. You know, it's always fun chatting with you. So is there anything that we haven't talked about that I haven't asked you about that you want to share or you think is important for people to know about your career, your work? Passion.
Well, yeah, I want to share a little more on the creativity that in the years, it's going back about 12 years ago when I was recovering from a couple life-threatening conditions, getting my body back, discovering I could dance again. There was this a lot of energy in me of it's time to create again. And I started singing again for the first time in years, and that led to the dancing. And the dance vehicle for me was Five Rhythms, which many people are familiar mm-hmm. with. It's an improv with structure, but it's very, very free and very much about finding flow and interacting with others and all that. So it was a lot of energy in me of just allowing this creative energy to come forth through me. And little by little, over the next couple of years, people started noticing, well, you're like singing again, dude. Like, what's going on? And damn, we didn't know you could dance. Damn, you're pretty good. And plus, they knew I'd recovered from cancer and staph infection in my blood and double hip replacement. I had a lot of heavy things going on. And I started getting called, you're like a Renaissance man. You're like, you're reborn physically, but also these things we didn't even know you did. And your photography is awesome, and like all this creative stuff going on. And so I kept hearing this kind of Renaissance theme and started pondering that for a while. And at one point I was thinking I should write a book about this, and everybody calls me a Renaissance man. And I thought, well, the term is rather limiting. It leaves out half the world's population, roughly. And then one day the term Renaissance human occurred to me. Renaissance human. I thought, ooh, I like that. That's it feels really different than Renaissance Man. Renaissance Man sounds like, oh, he's an attorney that's also a classical pianist, and he's pretty good with art too. Like he can do diverse, like a polymath. But Renaissance Human sounds different. And as I pondered what I meant by Renaissance Human, I thought, well, when I look at my life, this gets back to the reinventing comment that I made earlier. Yes, new things were born in me. If I look at my whole life is a series of births, actually. Like everybody. I mean, as you're growing up, you're literally coming into new skills. Your body is developing things. You're giving birth to the ability to ride a bike, the ability to play a sport, the ability to speak, the ability to see clearly. Is all these things you're giving birth to, so to speak. And building the neural circuitry to support it as you grow. And that keeps going on for years. But then at a certain point, especially as we enter the job market, it starts like, well, you better get solid now. You don't want to keep this growing thing going on too long because you got to get stable. And then God forbid you have a kid. Oh, now you're responsible for, I don't mean God forbid you have a kid, but when you have a kid, you got to be responsible for that, and then the mortgage, and then the sense of I'm still a living, breathing, growing, giving birth human. Well, maybe I gave birth to the kid, or I was part of that process, but not in my life anymore. And then, unfortunately, many people kind of lose that sense of I'm still growing, I'm still giving birth to new parts of myself, because you can't do that. That's too threatening, seemingly. And then God forbid you hit 40 or 50 or whatever around that age, and you start questioning your life and start feeling like this is not the job for me anymore. And then people, oh yeah, Bruce is having a midlife crisis. And I thought, that is so wrong. That is so wrong. That is a part of me that I've suppressed maybe for too long that's trying to be born. And then as I pondered deeper into this, I thought, this is what makes the human species different and than other species. We get to keep being born. We get to keep giving birth throughout our lives, as long as we want to believe this, into new parts of ourselves. And now it's shown that you're still creating new brain cells way into your 80s and probably longer if you keep curious enough and keep alive enough. So that's not stopping. If you're continuing to give birth to new brain cells, why wouldn't we continue to give birth to new interests, new capacities, new skills, or dust off the old ones and do them again, but better and more fun and less attached? And you know, so Renaissance Human for me became, we're all you Renaissance Humans, guys and girls. We all have the ability to continue to give birth to new parts of ourselves. We got to stay curious. We got to stay alive. And we got to stay open to what life is showing us. So if a song enters your heart, pay attention. If a moment enters your heart, pay attention. Like, what is this trying to tell me right now? Stay open. And so I call it Renaissance Human, not as a new category of artists. It's kind of the opposite of that. It's saying we all are made of creative energy. We all have the power to give birth, create another life. If that's not creative life force proof, I'll say to people, you got the power to create life. Prove to me you are not creative. Somehow that you didn't get the creative energy, and yet you have the power to create life. What's more creative than that? Mm-hmm. So, okay, I'm sorry you're not as good a painter as your sister. But that doesn't mean you're not as creative as her in every aspect of your life, and maybe more so in ways you haven't discovered yet. So my assumption about all of us humans is that we have all this a river of creativity flowing through us, but a lot of us keep telling ourselves, but I'm not creative. I can't change that situation. I don't have the power to do that. I can't really create my reality. No, Dr. Joe, you're a lovely man, but I don't really have the power to create my reality, you know. So I'm saying, yeah, no, you're just not going to prove that to me. You're not going to prove that to me. I mean, I still tell myself from time to time, I get stuck in things and like, no, I can't get over that one. Dude, seriously, you have gotten over life-threatening conditions, all these things. You've reinvented yourself many times. Your biological age is 30 years younger than your chronological age. Like, seriously, you're letting this situation take you to your knees. Really?
I know, and then you're like, dang, I can't be a wuss about this one, or I can't really allow myself to get stuck even though I want to.
Yeah. I mean, I understand it all because I've felt it all. So I'm not like judging anybody for any of that, but I try to be playful about it too, like, because that's what my soul does to me. Like, dude, seriously, you're going to let this take you out? Mm-hmm. Really? That email, is that bad? You know, or whatever.
I know, that's so funny. Yeah, thank you for sharing that. The piece, I like that, the image of like the creative power to create life. Is you know, my wife was saying something to me the other day, like I was just like writing down business ideas for like affiliate partnerships or something, and she's like, oh, you're so creative. I was like, this isn't creativity, but it's nice to have that acknowledgement, right? Like, creativity flows through in different ways. Like, it doesn't have to be an artistic expression form necessarily.
So here's my, exactly, that's one of my major points, is that as a society, we call the artistic people in businesses, oh, give it to the creatives. Really? So in HeartMath, there's a guy named Eric, who is the, I think he's still the director of operations at HeartMath. He is one of the most creative guys in that company. Is he a poet, a dancer, an artist, or a photographer? Not that I know of. Never seen any of that. And yet, as in the business, man, you had a problem, you'd give it to Eric. He could figure out a solution. Tell me that's not creative. A problem with a customer, a problem with a supply, a problem with a product, a problem with whatever. A problem arises, most everybody's stumped. Let's get Eric in on this. He would come up with an idea. We would often say, what a creative idea. Mm. Was a poem involved? No. When did we decide creativity only related to art history? And yet we all believe that, so you're not alone. So my other story to illustrate this was, the year 2017 was a very big year for me. It was the year I approached Stanford. I'd been teaching there for 20 years already. And I said, I've got something new I'm working on. It's around creativity. And they got super excited in this first meeting, and they said, how soon can you develop this for us? And so 4 months later, I was teaching this course on creativity at Stanford. And it was a bit of a whirlwind to get it developed. And, mm-hmm. and this was Stanford. I mean, this is not a little community
better
college.
Better be good, somewhere. Yeah.
Better be good. And at the same time, I knew I was very well liked by this group. They were an awesome client. So they were like very excited. So I knew I had, even if it wasn't perfect at first, I knew I had a lot of leeway. So I'd been teaching there for so long. I was a valued instructor. So that was going on. I was creating that program. So big challenge, never created a creativity course before. 2 months into that process, I'm approached about hiring these two remarkable singer-songwriters who are actual brothers, named the brothers Corin, Isaac and Toral Corin, dear friends of mine who were awesome performers and songwriters. And they're basically saying, hire us, we'll help you create an album of original songs because we see music in you. And I'm sitting there listening to this pitch to spend quite a lot of money to write songs with them. And I sat there and I said, so does it matter that I've never even wanted to write a song? And they laughed and they said, no, because we see the music in you. And I pondered that for a while, like for a week. And I said, they are absolutely right. Mm. And I need to go. And this is crazy financially. This is like the last thing I should be doing right now. And yet I said, this is a huge challenge for me. This, if I'm really serious about this Renaissance human, I will rise to the occasion and go for this, because it's way out of my comfort zone. I love music. I love singing. I write words in other contexts, but not lyrics to fit a song that's meaningful and not just like a pop song, you know, so that's a big challenge. And I had all the fears of, oh, Bruce is having a midlife crisis. He's got to release an album. those voices. And I went for it. Simultaneously, I had gotten to know a beautiful young woman in New York. And I was kind of falling for her. And I was going out once a month to New York to spend time with her. While I was in New York, all this album stuff was going on. I was also mm-hmm. in the midst of this creativity stuff. And so a lot of the creative juices were all getting awakened. Now I'm going back to New York, where I had a career in musical theater. Mm-hmm. And I had friends still there, still, you know, really successful friends. And I'd see them and they'd say, dude, you got to move back to New York. You'd get work, piece of cake now, because there's not many healthy guys your age that can still sing and dance compared to when you were doing it when you were in your 20s. Yeah, exactly. So I'm getting turned on by the idea of New York and all the rest. But the point of the story was, so I'm in this long distance relationship, living in California, she's in New York. while I'm working on this album, while I'm working on developing this course for Stanford. So which was the biggest creative challenge? That's the question. Which is the biggest creative challenge? I'll save you the time. The answer was the relationship.
Mm.
Because it's a long distance relationship. She was a generation younger and she was born and raised in Russia. So cultural experience radically different from mine. Her parents were like the polar opposite of mine. She was raised in Soviet Russia as it was breaking up.
Wow.
So the cultural challenge of just maintaining a relationship at a distance with all those things was a big creative challenge, bigger than doing an album of original songs that I'd never written a song in my life or creating a course on creativity. But that didn't mean it wasn't a creative challenge. So it was still like, how do I build this? What do I do to, because I think this matters. I think this relationship matters to me. So that's the story, is that you could just say, oh, of course the album is the biggest creative challenge, or of course creating a course on creativity, that's a big creative challenge. Well, no, actually the bigger challenge was the relationship at distance with all the issues that we had.
Yeah, I've had some friends that have dated people from other parts of the world where there's like a totally different context for what relationships are, and it sounds really challenging. And you've just reminded me that so I have a bucket list which I haven't updated in a while, but one of the items on there is to write a pop song that is kind of like Michael Franti or Bono. They have these uplifting songs that they're catchy, but they like slip in like a message that makes you sort of feel better about life. Subversive positivity kind of thing. I would love to create something like that.
I will send you. So as soon as you said that, one of the songs from my album, which is called Renaissance Human, that's the name of the album. It's on Apple Music, Spotify, Amazon, all the places. The song that is the most similar, and I've had similar references about it, is called Yeah, I'm Me. Yeah, I'm Me. And so the lyrics are all autobiographical. I co-wrote the song with these guys. I'll send you the link. There's a YouTube video about it, a music video of it, of the song. And
Cool.
And it's a catchy song. Like when you hear the chorus, it's just, this is fun. I like this. It has a deeper spiritual message, and it is about humanity. It's about celebrating I am me. And the chorus is, yeah, I'm me, oh, oh, yeah, I'm free, oh, oh, love is free, oh. And so that's the chorus, and it's very catchy, and you just kind of want to sing it. But the lyrics are also about being true to yourself and almost breaking down. And so there's a lot of message in the uplift. That you kind of come out of it and realizing that I'm me, I am me. You're gonna know when I'm being me, because I'm gonna say it like it is. So I'll share the link with you because
I love it. It's cool. Yeah. Do you sing those songs to yourself? Do you ever like sing your old songs that you've written?
Yeah, sometimes if I'm driving, I'll put it on in the car and sing with myself. Absolutely.
Fun.
Yeah.
What fun.
It's fun. And part of why I even did the album was when the guys, these brothers, I want to give another shout out to them, the brothers Koren, K-O-R-E-N, because they actually, you said you wanted to write a song, they actually do workshops where you get to write a song yourself, not going through the whole process. I went through with them for months and, you know, of actually going into a studio, doing an album and releasing it in the whole nine yards. But they actually had this process so the brothers Koren are the ones. But anyhow, it was a thrilling process because I literally never even imagined writing a song, let alone a bunch of them, let alone turning it into an album, let alone releasing it. But Renaissance Human is the name, and I am so grateful that I did that, because one of the reasons I said yes was they said, you know, you're going to get a version of the album without your voice singing lead, which means you will be able, you could sing with that anywhere in the world, plug in your album. And you can sing with the actual recording, which sounds awesome. It's got backup singers and, you know, guitar, bass, keyboards, percussion. It's a full band kind of sound.
Cool.
And I could do that anywhere in a festival, in a conference, and sing live. I did that at a Breathwork Festival in Cabo a year ago exactly, and got 150 people. I trained them on the chorus first. So they'd be, yeah, me, oh, everybody was singing the chorus along with me. And then I'd sing the verses, which they didn't know. And then we'd all join in singing, got 150 people doing that together.
Amazing. Wow.
Yeah.
That's
awesome. When you hear the song, you'll get the vibe. It's got a very uplifting.
Yeah.
We'll
try to work a clip into the podcast recording here if we can.
Awesome. Sure. I'll send you the link so you can do what you want.
Super. Bruce, it's been really fun. Thank you so much for coming on today.
Absolutely, Derek. I'm so happy that we connected, thanks to Tyler via Jessica via whatever the group is that we were in. I'm not even remembering the name of the group, but whatever that Zoom.
Yeah, the Global Super Connectors. It's connecting people.
Global Super Connectors. Shout out to Jessica for the connection. Absolutely.
Yeah, wonderful. All right. Well, we'll be in touch, and I'll let you know when this comes out. Thank you so much.
Awesome. Thank you. Enjoyed it a lot.
Bye-bye. Yeah.